Yep. Give me a nod when you're ready. I'm like four. Jitter's ready. Stand by.
Hey everybody, welcome to this episode of Bullets and Bourbon. I'm Frank Gao, joined by my co-host Matt Gunmach. Today's guest is Dylan Kelly. He started off his Marine Corps career as a tracker stationed at Pendleton, and then he got selected for MSG. He served in a couple of embassies, and then he went to MSAU, which is the Marine Security Guard's augmentation unit. But most importantly, he is the newest addition to the Marine Corps shooting team's pistol team. So, at this time, I actually want to start off with a question about MSG, because we really haven't had anybody on who's served in that capacity before. So do you want to talk to us about how you got into MSG, where you went, and then what exactly MSAU entails?
Of course, yeah. First of all, thank you guys for having me on the pod. It's super cool to be on here, and thank you for giving me the opportunity. MSG was... So the Marine Security Guards, that was something I found out around the time I was promoted to corporal, which was about almost 4 years now, actually a little more than 4 years. And I wanted to do it, one, because of the travel, and two, it was something that kind of interested me, being able to work overseas, be at multiple different countries within a 3-year span. And the security aspect of it really interested me. So I put in a package around June of 2020. It got accepted around October 2020. And then I went to MSG school here in Quantico around January of 2021. From there, I went through the 3-month school, did my first post out in London. And then after that, I went to Lahore, Pakistan, and then ended up here in Quantico at MSAU. And it's been a really interesting past 3 years. And it's a program that I recommend a lot of Marines. Every day I tell them, if you get the chance to put a package in, do it. It's a great opportunity.
Real quick, I know Matt wants to ask you about tracks, but can you just talk to us about what MSAU entails?
So MSAU was started about 10 years ago after the Benghazi incident of 2011. And MSAU is basically almost a QRF for the Marine Security Guard program and for the Department of State. We are under a Title 10, I believe, which means that we can be called up, guns, equipment, everything is shipped, and we're in country within 48 hours. And it really is a great unit, because you never know when you're going to get a mission. And essentially, something comes down, we cover augments for different embassies and consulates. We do new embassy compound movements. We have VIPs for when the president, vice president, secretary of state travel, and we help security with the communication teams and other elements. And then we have what's called AODs, our augmentation orientation deployments, where we'll do essentially site security for an embassy or consulate and let the RSO section, the regional security officers, know how we can best employ ourselves at a embassy or consulate if we were to do an augmentation to that country.
Okay. And then did you mention how you get selected? Is it very selective, is that something everyone goes through?
It is very selective. Anyone can apply for it. You simply just put a package in like any other lateral move or any other special duty assignment. It gets even more selective when you go to the school. There's a lot of screenings that go through. You get a clearance, which is even more screening. They do a psych eval, which tests your your mentality, making sure that you're mentally fit to go overseas and essentially handle this job, because it is a lot of stressors once you get to your first post and you start learning the ins and outs of how everything works.
Very cool. Matt, you want to ask about tracks?
So you're a tracker, and for those who don't know what tracks are, it is an amphibious assault vehicle. It's a tracked vehicle. You know, the early forms of the tracks date back to what, World War II, you know, Iwo Jima, you know, the island hopping campaigns, all that kind of stuff. First, I want to know, did you choose that, or is that something you got voluntold to do whenever you enlisted?
That was something I was voluntold. I put in a combat support package when I first enlisted, and originally I wanted artillery. And then I get through boot camp, I get through MCT, I get my orders, and it says amphibious assault vehicle school. And I was like, this is an artillery. And next thing you know, I'm in Pendleton for the next, after that, it would have been the next 2 years, went through school and then ended up at Third Tracks.
So, and the reason why I'm asking is, like, one, a lot of people probably don't know what tracks are. We have switched from the AEVs to the ACVs, the amphibious combat vehicle, I think it is.
Yes.
But my whole career, I was in an infantry battalion, I was always a track company in Iraq. We rode around in tracks the entire time, clearing out city after city, and they would just follow in tow, and then we'd jump in it. You know, whenever I went on the Mew, we were a track company. And for the, you know, so tracks are not just land vehicles, but they're also amphibious vehicles. So they are off the coast, you know, you're about 8 nautical miles off the coast of whatever area you're going to. And then, you know, and then you go about 8 knots, you know, and, you know, it takes an hour to get to land. And, you know, everything is, you know, closed up and water's leaking in the whole time, and you're just in a tin can. One thing, what is the most amount of people that you fit in a track before?
I would say probably 20 plus.
Okay. My record was 29.
29.
And that was a full machine gun section, a sniper team, and then my whole squad.
I've heard of like 30 people being able to fit in a track. My track usually always had the machine gunners, so I usually had a little bit less than what the other tracks had, just because they had all the 240s, had all the ammo. So I usually had less amount of guys, but I've seen a good amount of guys stuffed into one vehicle, too many to count.
Yeah, the tracks have always been the bane of my existence, and I don't know how I always got stuck with the track company. But, you know, looking back, it's kind of cool, but in the moment, it's fucking miserable.
Looking back at it, there was a lot of cool things about it. Shooting a Mark 19, a 50 cal machine gun was probably the best thing about it. And then splashing off ship was, you know, being in the wide open ocean in a, you know, big metal box it's pretty cool at the time. But everything else that follows, the maintenance, the records, everything with it was just that kind of took away from the cool things at times. Yeah,
my first firefight, big firefight, was exiting a track. So we were pushing in the city of Ubaidi, you know, and we hear the bullets just pinging off the walls or off the, you know, sides of the tracks, and we're just like, well, fuck. And I'm like the first guy out with a 249 saw. That door starts opening up, and that thing moves slow. If anybody knows anything about tracks, those rear hatches, they come down into a ramp and they go just extremely slow, and it's fucking miserable because the whole time you're thinking, well, this is fucking it. You run out, and like miraculously nobody got killed in that situation, but it was a hairy situation, you know, having, you know, we were getting shot at, I think, from like 3 different sides that day.
They can be bullet magnets, and those rear hatches can be slow, but I've also seen them be, it's called a combat drop, where essentially your hydro just goes out and that big heavy ramp just slams on the deck.
Yeah, and the armor on them, like when they put the armor packages on them, whenever like we were in Iraq, I mean, they stopped like RPGs. Like one of our tracks, our track got hit by an RPG. Nobody was in it at the time, but I mean, I think it put maybe a nickel sized hole in it, and that was about it. You know, the way the deflectors are on the armor.
Yeah, the eco armor on the tracks was definitely a big addition to them. It definitely up armored us a little bit.
But I mean, it's about time that we did finally transition, because we'd been using those vehicles since Vietnam.
Since 1972, I believe, is when the first P7 came out.
Mm. So like,
if there's I remember been a lot my of track history correctly.
Yeah, there's been a lot of retrofits and upgrades on them.
Oh yeah.
So do you have a tattoo of a chicken and a pig on your feet?
I do not. I don't have any tracker tattoos. It seems to be a pretty big tradition with the tracker community, is to get some sort of track related tattoo.
And for the listeners who are wondering, why the fuck would you get a pig and a chicken on your feet? The reason being is like old history of like, you know, people sailing the oceans. Whenever there would be a shipwreck and they would have cargo or livestock and stuff, the two things that would float would be a pig and a chicken.
Yep.
Do you eat apricots?
So I do. I was one of those weird trackers that didn't believe in that superstition. There used to be there's a monster juice out there that has apricots in it, and I would bring it on my track because I didn't believe in it. My schoolhouse instructor didn't believe in it. So like, I would bring it on my track, and my track would be completely fine throughout most of the field ops that we would do. And it was the other tracks that would break down and have problems, and those were the ones that believed in it, and they all blamed me. But I was like, it never touched your track.
Yeah, well, good discussion about that particular community. But as you and I were getting to know each other, Dylan, we talked about, you know, playing sports growing up. And if I remember correctly, you played some baseball and some football. Any other sports? And if so, what positions in those sports?
Baseball and football were the main ones growing up. I dabbled in a few others. I dabbled in lacrosse, hockey, a couple other sports. But baseball and football were the main ones that I stuck to. In football, I was a quarterback for a little bit. Then everyone around high school time hit their growth spurt before I did, so they switched me to receiver. For baseball, I stayed middle infield, short, second base, played a little outfield, but middle of the diamond is where I stayed mostly.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you played some pretty prevalent skill positions. And, I mean, I really didn't get beyond Little League, but usually you put your stud players at shortstop. They're going to see the most hits. They're expected to make a throw to every single base. So, and, you know, wide receiver, quarterback, it's a team sport, but any given time, you are expected to make the play at that moment. Does that spotlight pressure translate to competitive shooting for you?
It does. I would say it does. And kind of once you're that shooter on the line and you hear that, you know, make ready command and that standby, it's kind of like, it almost feels like all eyes are on you in a way, even though that maybe the squad behind you is doing whatever. They're punching mags, cleaning mags, talking to other people, doing whatever. But they're all behind me, and it does feel like, you know, all eyes are on you. And it, in a way, I like that. It may sound weird to say, but in a way, I kind of like those all eyes on me situations, because it forces me to stay focused and stay locked in at the task at hand.
Yeah, you've had plenty of opportunities to meet the expectations of the moment. So it's nothing new. So in the difference between, you know, a lot of those sports you talked about were team sports. Are there things you miss about like being on like a true team? I know you're part of the pistol team now, but it's substantially different from being on a football team, a baseball team, or a lacrosse team. And then on the flip side, is it liberating in some ways to just be responsible for yourself and your own performance?
I would say the the things that I miss about being on one of those team-based sports is I miss that kind of cohesiveness to want to be better as a team. You're not so much trying to focus on making yourself better, but trying to integrate your skills with other people's skills where some people may be lacking, you can make up and vice versa to be able to make the team as a whole better. The one thing I do like now, kind of being in a little bit more of a individual sport, is now it's all on me. Whether I succeed or fail is purely on me alone. So it forces me to really fine tune my mechanics and my fundamentals and make sure that I'm on point every time that that timer goes off.
Well said. So getting selected for something like MSAL, I would imagine that the marksmanship requirements and the way you guys train shooting differed from conventional MSG than to your transition to MSAL. How was that?
It was definitely a step up from the original kind of marksmanship training you get with MSG. The schoolhouse for MSG was focused on a lot of trying to get you qualled and familiarized with the weapons that Department of State uses. At MSAL, they tried to instill the mindset of you're going to be potentially, you know, pushed to these high risk environments where you may potentially have to engage a threat with your weapons. And so it was a lot of hammering those fundamentals, making sure your shots are actually on target and you're not throwing rounds on a different target or you're completely missing. It was also a lot of shoot, no shoot situations, having that trigger, that safety discipline, and really understanding how to be effective with your weapons. And it really drove me to be a better shooter.
Okay. And then during that MSAL pipeline, at what point did you start getting involved with competitive shooting?
I started getting involved with competitive shooting around July of last year. It was, I think Dustin Potter a lot. I'll give a quick shout out to him. He really got me involved in it. And it started with Quantico Shooting Club. The team was hosting a two-gun match. And the shooting team and MSAL have a pretty good relationship where they'll bring us to matches. We'll bring them on our ranges, let them shoot our different, you know, packages and all that. And I started a two-gun match shooting with our, you know, our issued weapons. And I was horrible. It really put into perspective of, like, there was a lot I needed to work on fundamentally. And I think that really drove me to do more matches. And I talked to Dustin one day. I was like, hey, I kind of want to shoot some more matches. How do I get into it? And he's like, all right, I'm signed up for a match. Let's go sign up. And it was like, oh, okay. I signed up. And from there, it took off.
Real quick, I want to go back to marksmanship training within MSAL. Obviously, you described a pretty rigorous training pipeline in order to be a part of it. But what was the attrition rate, and could you get dropped from the program for poor marksmanship?
You could get dropped for poor marksmanship. They give you 3 attempts to qual at the Department of State standards. And if you don't meet that qual, you go on a review board and see if you get another attempt, or they, you know, move you somewhere else. As far as MSAL shooting packages, a lot of it was, all right, well, now you qualled with your weapon system. Now we need you to be better than that. And putting you in those high stress environments, putting shoot, no shoot targets, understanding, like, you have to have all your hits in a 6x12 box center mass on a target. And if you don't, why didn't you? That round could hit an innocent civilian at an embassy. And you have to account for that. So it was definitely a lot more rigorous coming to MSAL and really hammering every round you shoot, you have to be accountable for.
So you mentioned Dustin Potter, and, you know, he's the one who really got you into competitive shooting. He's also one of your instructors over at MSAL, if I remember correctly. So obviously, he competes a lot. He's a very good shooter, extremely accurate. He's traveled to a lot of major USPSA matches. But would you say that, like, The training that you received in MSAO, does it more align with competitive shooting than conventional Marine Corps marksmanship?
I would say at MSAO it does. I would say it does in line with it a little bit more, because with those stressors of trying to get all those shots center mass, you translate that to competitive shooting. No one wants to shoot no shoot targets or mics or deltas. You want two alphas every time. So translating, taking that from the MSAO marksmanship over to competitive shooting, when I see a Charlie or Delta, I take a step back and look like, why did I throw that shot there? Was my sights off? Was it something with my grip positioning? So it definitely translated a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a real sense of consequence for the shots that didn't go where you were supposed to put them. That's definitely different from the way the traditional Marine Corps trains. Speaking of training, you did take a class from David Wampler and Kevin Gorosby, two very good shooters in our area. What are some things that you took from that class that made an immediate impact that are already contributing to your game? And then what are some back burner skills that you know, probably after this slew of major matches that you're going to have to go back and reassess?
Some things I took from that class, they were talking a lot about target transitions and really understanding that bump transition and using essentially your whole body to transition to a target and your throttle control, going from a close 5-yard target all the way to a 15-yard target. We don't want the transition to be slower. We just need to have control of our trigger and essentially throttling down and throttling up when we need to. For the major matches coming up, I definitely will probably look back at those matches and look at my positioning a lot. Movement and positioning is definitely something that I've been trying to isolate and work on a lot now, to where it doesn't become that much of an issue for those major matches, especially when they're going to start integrating longer courses, 30 round count courses. You got to go from one end of the bay to the other. It's definitely something that I'm going to probably look back at and be like, all right, I need to fix entry positions there. I need to work on exiting in this position, and so on and so forth.
Nice.
So Frank reloads, I reload. A lot of people we talk to reload, and you know, most people are interested in learning how to make their own ammo, but just don't know where to start. You know, I started reading books. Like, I read books, I talked to friends. But you know, Frank took you in and he successfully, you know, taught you how to reload, you know, tested ammo, produced a couple thousand rounds. How does reloading knowledge work into your shooting now?
It works a lot in terms of understanding how my gun performs, knowing everything about how my gun shoots with different types of grain size of ammo, how much powder I'm putting into the casing, really getting a deep dive of not only is my gun shooting faster with the muzzle velocity, but understanding how my sights are moving on the return. Going all the way from just loading with 4 grains of powder all the way to 4.6, just that 0.6 of a difference is huge when you start doing double drills, bill drills, even just firing one round, you notice a massive difference. And it really opened my eyes to how much you can learn just from your ammo with your gun. So it was definitely eye-opening to me. There was just so much more that I learned just from loading ammo about firearms than most firearm instructors out there.
No, totally. I mean, like, you can, like, for those who reload, they'll tell you, like, there's a clear difference between factory loads and hand loads, you know, specifically in recoil. Like, you know, you get a box of Federal 150 grain, you know, or 124 grain, you know, it's going to be notably different in the way it shoots. And essentially the same thing goes with hand loads. Like, you tune your ammo to that gun, and then you basically stick to that recipe for the rest of the life cycle. You don't deviate from grains, you don't deviate from bullet weights, you don't deviate from any of that stuff. And I mean, it's pretty magical what you can achieve in competition with finely tuned ammunition.
It was even shooting a local match with the factory ammo, just watching the difference on my shot placements, I noticed that I had much tighter groups when I found an ammo that was tailored to not only my gun, but to me, a gun or an ammo load that I found that every time I put two on paper that I knew where my sight was going to land every time. And I knew that once I pulled that trigger, that's where that round was going to go. And it took a massive weight off my shoulders from being able, like, I don't know if this ammo is going to land here, if it's going to land there. I've been having problems with it, or something just doesn't feel right with it, to where every time I load that ammo, I know where those rounds are going to place, and I know where my sight's going to land every time. And it's something that I don't have to consciously think about once that timer starts.
So how do I put this? You're probably one of the fastest turnarounds in getting orders and reenlisting in the Marine Corps to the shooting team. I had, like, whenever I heard you were coming to the team, I was just like, he EASs in a month, and then he's coming to the team. It could have been even less time than that, but I don't remember exactly. But it's like, that was a quick turnaround, because about a month ago, you weren't even sure if you would be coming to the team, if your reenlistment was up in the air. Like, you almost got out of the Marine Corps. Then all of a sudden, your package was accepted and found yourself at championships. You earned a silver pistol medal and the interdivisional team pistol medal. How did you prep yourself for your first championships, and what are some adjustments you'll make when you shoot it next year?
Some of the adjustments I made, I think for me, it was more of a mental or a mentality switch, especially coming off Mi'kmaq East, where I had, to me, a subpar performance, not placing very high and just not shooting the best that I could. It was more of a mentality switch of when I went to champs, it was like, to me, it was a fresh start. It was a new match. Mi'kmaq East already happened. Forget about it. It's a new match. Just go out and, one, have fun, and two, shoot your match. And I think that mentality switch just completely changed everything. Now, was everything perfect at the match? Did I shoot 2 alpha every time and have the best hit factors out there? No. But the difference I had from Mi'kmaq East to champs was more of a personal achievement for me than it was receiving the silver medal and the team medal. So it was more of a mentality thing that really changed from, not knowing I was going to shoot champs to all of a sudden, hey, next week you're shooting champs. As far as for next year's champs or next year's Mi'kmaqs, I think the next year I really want to get my gas gun shooting better. My gas gun tends to really kick my butt at these Mi'kmaqs, and it's something that I really need to work on and get with the other team guys and figure out, like, how do I make this better and how do I stay consistent with it. For action or multi-gun, like action type stuff, really want to improve my action rifle a lot. I finished 18th overall in action rifle, and I'd like to see my placement go up. For pistol, I'm just going to basically be doing the same things that I've been doing here, just trying to fine tune mechanics and really hone in those skills.
So one of the biggest mental breakthroughs you had, I guess, was at East, you still weren't sure if you were going to be in the Marine Corps, whereas in championships, you knew?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, yeah, I could see anybody, like, in that situation, like, I'm probably going to have to get out of the Marine Corps, I'm here. I could see the mental, you know, that mental block just going away. And like, you know, at that point, I don't want to say you made it, because every day it's a performance on demand. It's always training, you know, the work just, you know, the work is just going to get started now. And it's always going to be a constant development process now that you're on the team. But yeah, I mean, good for you, man. Like, that's a lot of mental pressure to get through, you know, at East. And, you know, you're probably putting a lot of, you know, you're critiquing yourself harder than anybody else would. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, like, it wasn't bad. So, you know, moving along this summer, you're going to be shooting Delmarva, Buckeye Blast, and notably the Cary Optics Nationals. One, is this like, have you shot major matches before?
I have not. So I'm probably, it's funny because I was supposed to shoot Cary Optics Nats last year, got sent on a mission, so I wasn't able to shoot Cary Optics Nats. So I have no major matches under my belt.
So now that you're going to be going to some of these bigger matches, what are some of the personal goals going into this season?
Some personal goals for me is, one, don't think too much about the fact it being a major match. I want to go in and treat it as a local and be a little bit more relaxed, have fun, and really shoot my best match every time I get on. Every time I get on the start stick, fault line, I just want to go up there with the mentality of it's just a local, go out there, shoot your best match. As well as I want to really take in as much knowledge as I can from all the best shooters in the area at Cary Optics Nats, the best shooters in the country, and really just try and pick brains of people and find things that can improve my game just that much more.
No, that's a fairly good goal. You know, those are good open-ended goals that'll help you in the future. You know, you can't just put those performance goals down, because it's not, if you just do performance, you're going to get burnt out. Whereas if you have it open-ended like that, I see it benefiting you a lot more. You know, it's always about that journey of learning.
With these major matches coming up and me not having any major matches under my belt, I didn't want to set a performance goal and put that mentality of like, oh, I need to meet this goal, I need to place a certain spot, or I need to have these certain hit factors, because I didn't want to put all that mental pressure on myself. I start getting in my head, and it ends up being that's when I absolutely screw stages up. I mess up my stage plans. I start throwing no shoots. The more relaxed I stay, the better I find myself shooting.
No, that's good. That's a good mentality to have that a lot of people, quite honestly, don't have. They think that they need to set those performance goals, and then they don't make them, and then they get demotivated, and then, you know, who's to say they come back? But no, having it like that, you're in a good spot, and you're surrounded by really good people to kind of keep you on that path.
Absolutely.
So you started your journey like many Marines do, you know, as a barracks Marine. You know, you had to dry fire and whatever factory ammo work in whatever way possible. What advice would you give to others in a similarly restricted situation?
I would say my advice is try to connect with people that are in the same community, as well as really, really look out and try and find places that you can do your dry fire. Obviously, we can't do them in the barracks with all the rules and restrictions. I was fortunate enough to have the team guys be able to give me a spot to be able to dry fire. So I would say find someone or somewhere to do your dry fire, even if it's out in the middle of the woods somewhere. Nothing stopping you from setting up a target out there and just getting those reps in.
You know, one thing I'll add, you know, and you know, just thinking in that frame of mind, like, I'm a Lance Corporal, I'm a corporal, I'm a young sergeant who lives in the barracks, and like, how do I get into competitive shooting? And if and most people here, they already know, but for those that don't, and those that are Marines or even civilians, it doesn't really matter. One thing I would say do is go on practice. Like, if you don't know anybody in the community, there's a website called Practice Score, P-R-A-C-T-I, and then score.com. You know, register for an account, and then you can search for matches in the area. You know, if you're not entirely sure of registering for a match or even what you're getting into, just figure out when that match is, go observe, meet, you know, do a meet and greet, talk to people, and then see if you can build that community and just get the assistance you need. Hey, I'm first time doing this. I've never seen this before. I'm very interested. What would you recommend? You know, and just go and talk to people. I think that's one of the best things that you can do. Don't be, don't be afraid to ask questions.
100%. I've yet to go to a match and find someone that wasn't willing to help out a new shooter and answer any questions they have, whether it was about the gun you're using, how to do a stage, what's the best way to go about this. It's really been a great community to be a part of, and I enjoy every match I go to.
No, that's awesome. But at this point, we've asked all the questions that we had planned, but is there anything that you'd like to add?
I thank you guys again for having me on the podcast. It really is it's a big thing for me for you guys to ask me to be on here. It's definitely nice to come on and kind of tell a story a little bit. To anyone who's listening, just get out there, train. You never know what you're going to accomplish if you don't train, and just have fun with anything that you do. Don't wrap your head around it too much. Don't dig yourself in the dumps. I've done it. It's hard to dig yourself out, but go out, have fun, train, and just be the best you can be.
Awesome. Well, to our listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have any questions for us, Dylan, anybody on the Marine Corps shooting team, please reach out. We'll put you in contact with them. And we just hope you enjoyed this. If you like what you're hearing, please give us a rating and a review. We'd really appreciate that. And until next time, we'll talk to you later.